latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
All right, carry the four plus this, I got that. All right. 26,876. What's that? That's how many races you could have bet last summer on ExpressBet. Haven't signed up for an account yet? What are you waiting for? On top of all those races, ExpressBet's giving away 25 million XB rewards points with promotions at Saratoga, Del Mar, and more. Plus, ExpressBet's Fun in the Sun Handicapper Tournament features $120,000 in prizes, including seats to the 2020 Pegasus Betting Championship. I know, I'm throwing a lot of numbers at you here, but here's one more. 500. That's the sign-up bonus you could get when you sign up for ExpressBet. So let's recap. 26,000 races, $500 sign-up bonus, $120,000 handicapper tournament, and 25 million rewards points. Hey, this math just adds up. ExpressBet is your way to play this summer. Must be 18 or older and 21 in certain states. Open an account with ExpressBet and reside in a state where such activity is legal, void, or prohibited. National Gambling Support Line, 800-522-4700.
With 35 years at the forefront of sports technology, Stats provides next-generation sports content for basketball, baseball, football, soccer. And now, Stats is turning its sights to horse racing. RaceLens is the most in-depth product on the market. With innovative analytics powered by data from Equibase, it will change the way you follow horse racing. Stats RaceLens, bringing clarity to handicapping. Learn more at stats.com/RaceLens.
Learn the business of horses in the world's only accredited equine business program, the University of Louisville Equine Business Program. The University of Louisville has a legacy of excellence for more than 25 years of equine business education. Classes are taught by industry experts in state-of-the-art facilities located in the heartland of America's equine industry. The University of Louisville Equine Business Program. When it comes to horses, we mean business. For more information, visit business.louisville.edu/equine.
Now, back to At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
We're back at the races about just a little past the bottom of the hour, and Brad Thomas will join us. I just got a call. He's going to be a little bit after 11:10. Brad Thomas, who's got all kinds of publicity duties this week, certainly Haskell week, and Steve Haskin, meanwhile, ready to join us. And Steve, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. How are you? Welcome.
Excellent.
New Jersey.
Thank you. Thank you. You're not far away. You're
hour,
an easy...
less than an hour, 50 minutes.
Yeah.
So where are you? In the usual press office corner?
Yes, I'm in my spot that since the Breeders' Cup here.
You're not disturbing anybody who's working in there, are you?
I probably am, and I feel terrible, but they only have to put up with me for 3 hours today, 3 hours tomorrow, and actually they're down to 90 minutes today. It's one of my favorite stops now over the years, you know, and it all started with that Breeders' Cup when we were still a 4-7 show, and I got here early in the morning each day and ended up basically pitching in with John's staff, John Himes' staff, and you know, people were calling and about the train service and you know, do we get in if I'm a New Jersey horseman? Does my pass get me into the Breeders' Cup? And I ended up creating a kind of something that John and I laugh about every year ever since.
That was a great Breeders' Cup up until the Friday of Breeders' Cup weekend.
Yeah.
You know, but then it turned into an absolute total nightmare.
And for those that weren't here or remember, it was glorious. Monday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday.
And they were predicting good weather too. Or the week before, when I went to the draw, like on Monday or something or whatever it was, I went to the draw, and they were saying, oh, the weather forecast is for beautiful weather over the weekend. It wasn't. Friday was much worse than Saturday.
Yeah, Friday was horrific. It just did not stop raining, but it was 75 degrees, 78 degrees, and sunny and beautiful every single day. And we all just kept saying, oh, my gosh, if it's like this, it's going to be perfect. And instead, everybody has this negative memory, which is so unfair. I do remember, though, Steve, if you remember, right before the Breeders' Cup turf.
The sun came out.
And yeah. Yeah, it was a little late at that point, but there are plenty of memories in those 2 days. You know, it was the first expanded Breeders' Cup, right? With the filly and mare sprint, and it was the first filly and mare sprint because Merrifield was a house horse, right. From Doug O'Neill.
Here's a question for you, by the way: who was the most famous trainer to win a Breeders' Cup race that day?
The most famous trainer on the Friday or just over the weekend?
Saturday.
The most famous trainer. Well, English Channel won. La Houdoud won. Midnight Lute won. Who am I not thinking of? Who are you? What are you coming up with here?
It's actually a question I just thought of right now. It's actually kind of a great question. I'll put quotes around the word trainer.
So it was somebody that was a horse running in somebody's name that normally wouldn't have.
Or reverse.
You got me.
You give up?
I do.
It was an unknown assistant named Chad Brown.
Well,
Bobby Frankel didn't come to the Breeders' Cup.
Oh, so you're saying I get
Chad Brown saddled Ginger Punch.
Nice. Okay,
that's how he became famous. Nobody ever heard of him. Nobody heard. He was Bobby Frankel's assistant in Canada. Not even his assistant in New York. He was his assistant in Canada, and. Bobby was already getting sick, and also his dog was dying, Happy.
Yeah.
And he didn't come. So he had Chad saddle his horses. And when Ginger Punch won the distaff, Chad was the only one there. Everybody interviewed Chad, and that's how people knew who Chad Brown was. Nobody ever heard of him. And then shortly after that, he left Bobby to go out on his own. He had gotten so much publicity from Ginger Punch and from talking
How
to
funny.
The media that he wound up going out on his own.
I love it.
That's how's that for a trivia question?
That's the rest of the story.
Yeah, people forget that. Chad Brown. Nobody. I mean, he was.
Wait a minute.
Virtual unknown. I mean, nobody had a clue who Chad Brown was.
No, who says they forgot it? They didn't know it. I mean, I did not. I was unaware. There you go. I love it. Good job, Steve. Well, Steve,
that's actually about when the sun started to come out. It was around the distaff, and by the time they ran the turf, the sky was already turning blue. I mean, it was it had this incredible lighting. The
yes.
lighting on that race when English Channel just drew away, and it was a very short field too. It was like 7 horse field or something. And everybody, the big horse was, I always forget the Aidan O'Brien horse. He won the Arc. I always get some of the names confused back then, but, he was a big horse and English Channel absolutely dusted him, won by like 7 lengths. But that's when the sun. By the time that was run, the sun it was glorious, beautiful sunshine.
Yeah.
And then, unfortunately, as bad a Breeders' Cup as it was, it had an end. In a very, very bad way when George Washington broke down in the Classic.
Yeah, that's right.
I was there. I saw Aidan and his wife leaving the track, and she was in tears, and he had his arm around her. It was very. very sad sight. And, you know, they brought the horse back from stud.
Right.
You know, so right. That was a way to close the Breeders' Cup.
No, that was rough. And by the way, since not to heap more tragedy on, there was an incident this morning, a collision at...
At Monmouth?
At Del Mar. Just got word a little bit ago. And I don't know how much of reporting has gone on, but...
Already?
Just a loose horse. Well, it can happen anytime. I mean,
I know. The last thing they need is any bad publicity, even though it has nothing to do with the track.
Well, this loose horses, loose horse scenarios are you know, grave dangers. Apparently, a Carla Gaines collided with a Bob Baffert. Asa.
That's like the worst scenario. That's even worse. I mean, yeah, as bad as it is when a horse is injured. Horses colliding with each other is this, I remember I was at Churchill Downs one morning, and horses were standing by the rail. There's a bunch of horses standing by the rail, and then all of a sudden a loose horse came and was running right towards them. And I was standing with Bob and Jill, and you could see it coming. You say, "What?" I said, "Where's this horse going?" I don't know. He was trying to get around them. There was, like, you know, 2 inches behind them. And I saw it coming, and I turned my head. I couldn't look, and I heard it. You could hear this thud, and Jill just, like, broke down in tears. Just started to walk away. She didn't know what to do with herself. It was, I can't even imagine what it was like to have seen it. I mean, just hearing the thud. There's nothing more scary than that. And we just ran right into the poor horse and was just standing there.
Well, we'll get details, I'm sure. I would imagine Jay is there, and correspondence. So watch for this story with details. Asa Espinoza, I believe, as well, injured. Always hard. Well, Steve, speaking, I want to get one other conversation in. The passing of Sea Hero and... the beautiful job in New York. They crafted a Paul Mellon color blanket of flowers to put on Sea Hero in the Saratoga paddock. Look for the picture. I'll send you the picture. Pat McKenna, who's going to be with us later to talk about the heat protocols. It's on his feed. You've got to have some vivid Sea Hero memories, I imagine.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I remember. Well, first, you know, it was in the early days of my Derby coverage. I was covering the Derby with Ed Fontaine, and I was sharing. Joe was still doing the lead coverage. And Ed and I were doing the work patrol and writing features. And so we would report on the horses, you know, each day. You know, and then the following year is when Joe... couldn't do it anymore, and I wound up taking over the lead coverage. But, you know, people look at Sea Hero's past performances, and they see, you know, obviously a very, very inconsistent horse. You never knew what you were going to get from him. But when he fired, he always fired big. But, let's put it this way. Early in the year, if anybody told you that this horse was going to win the Kentucky Derby, you would think they were out of their mind. You know, first of all, you know, nobody was expecting him to win the juvenile. You know, he had gotten bet down. Not the juvenile, the champagne. You know, he had gotten bet down a little bit because he had broken his maiden and won an allowance race or so. But he just looked absolutely brilliant in champagne, and he ran like 34 and change. And, you know, which was, at the time, one of the faster champagnes. And everyone's expecting a lot of big things from him coming out as a three-year-old. And as a three-year-old, he was down in Florida, and he had run very poorly in the juvenile. And Mac Miller brought him back in all races to Palm Beach, which eventually wound up getting taken off the turf. And he just ran around the racetrack. I mean, he did absolutely nothing in there as the even money favorite. and then Mack ran him in an allowance race on the grass, and he got beat in that race at 6-5. So, and this is what completely changed him around. Mack Miller said, you know, he came to the conclusion he just did not like Florida, so he left Florida, and Mack Miller had a small farm in Aiken, and he sent him to his farm in Aiken, and he ordered, right from the start, he started to blossom, and he started to do much better, and Mack started to experiment with him. He started using all kinds of bits and bridles, and he just couldn't find anything he was comfortable with. He'd use ring bits and D bits and tongue ties and figure eights, and finally found that he was comfortable with the shore wing. Which, if people don't know what a shore wing is, go look at pictures of Seattle Slough and Majestic Prince, because they wore shore wings during their career. So he finally found him comfortable. And, you know, he decided to run him in the bluegrass. The Derby was not even under consideration at the time. He wasn't even thinking of Derby because he had shown nothing. And he gave him Lasix for the bluegrass just to, it never bled, but he wanted to keep him relaxed or so, keep his blood pressure down. So anyway, gave him a Lasix for the bluegrass. And if you look at the past performances, you see he ran fourth. But, I mean, he actually really woke up, and he made a big move. He tried to split horses, and he couldn't get through. And Gary Bailey had a check on him and just wait, and he never could get through. He finally got through late, and he only got beat like 2.5 lengths, 2.75 lengths or something like that. So it was a very sneaky race. What happened is that Mack Miller also had taken the blinkers off him that he had worn, and then put a cheating blinker on him in the bluegrass just to keep him a little bit focused. And then once he ran that race, he took the blinkers off, which is very unusual, completely for the Derby. So he'd be, you know, more relaxed. And Gerry Bailey, every single hole opened up for him. I mean, it was like, I think Gerry called it, at the time, I think he said it was like the parting of the Red Sea. Every time he saw a hole, it was the parting of the Red Sea. And then finally, at the end, there was an opening of the rails, very, very Ferdinand-like, with Bill Shoemaker. You know, a hole opened up on the rail, and Bailey, who was not a well-known rider at the time, he was just getting good. He went for the hole, and he got through, and he just absolutely, and he just drew away. And he just won going away. But it was an unbelievable job by Mack Miller, and it was such a popular result because, you know, Mack Miller was and Paul Mellon, you know, known as the Golden Boys at the time. Mellon was 85 years old, you know, obviously coming towards the end. And Mack Miller was 71, and it was one of the great trainers in the country, but had never won a Triple Crown race. You know, he was training the old Cragwood horses with Charles Engelhard. And then they're taking over from Elliot Birch and Mike Kaye with the Rokeby horses, and you know he had done well. He had some good horses with them. He wound up having a job of gold afterwards. But you have a 71-year-old trainer and an 85-year-old owner, so they were the Golden Boys, and it became a very, very popular result. And he comes back and he runs terrible in the Preakness and the Belmont. I mean, he just did absolutely nothing in either one of those races. And then, you know, he prepped him, you know, brought him to Saratoga, prepped him in the Jim Dandy, and he just ran dull. I mean, he ran an even race. He wound up a well-beaten fourth in the race. And then he goes in the Travelers and he blows everybody away. And it was actually a pretty good time for the time. It was like 2:01:04, I think. And he won. He won going away. And after that, he never did anything after that.
No,
he was nothing as a 4-year-old. I think he won his first start in an allowance race in the mud, and then he lost his last 7 races, running mostly on the grass, and just a strange course. But just look at the 3 days he picked to be a champion: the Champagne, the Kentucky Derby, and the Travers. Talk about, I mean, that's like the golden trifecta for New York racing. if you're looking at the three, adding the Derby, of course, but if you look at the three most historic races, the most historic race for two-year-olds was the Champagne, that along with the Hopeful, and then, of course, the Derby, and then, of course, the Travers. So he won three of the most prestigious races in the country. But in between, he was could never figure him out. Really could never have. But when he was on, he didn't win by a nose. He won going away every one of his races. And then Mac donated that statue, for the paddock. So, a lot of people, nowadays, you look back how long it's been now, a lot of people come in the paddock and say, who's that? A lot of people don't even realize, why is there a statue of Sea Hero? Well, Mac Miller had donated it, and it was good. I mean, it's a fixture there now, so it belongs there. But he's the oldest Derby winner. Which now that honor now goes to Gopher Jin, who won the following year.
Now it was special, and it was part of a sequence that. You think about Mrs. Genter, and I remember there being there was this whole
a few years after that. So the whole thing about the geriatric owner.
Yes, getting their derbies.
Yes, and that was the whole era of that. All the horses of the early 90s. Excuse me, all the horses of the early 90s were owned by. The whole time, but I mean, the thing with Mrs. Genter started it all. I mean, that was just the most amazing thing. It really put ABC on the map too, because the best thing ABC ever did was having the camera on Carl Nasker. And I remember they could have had the camera on anybody in that race, because it's not like he was a big favorite. He was like 10-1 in the race. He just finished third in the Bluegrass Stakes. So to have a camera on them, and then for so many times I've always asked Carl, I said, Carl, I mean, was that natural, or were you playing to the camera? And he swears that he didn't completely forgot that the camera was even there. But, I mean, when he pointed, you could follow from their eyes, and he pointed straight ahead. He pointed to her. He says, look, right there. As he was passing by them. And then when he said, Mrs. Genter, you won the Kentucky Derby, and hugged her. Oh, my God, that was still the best thing I ever saw.
Mrs. Genter, I love you.
Yeah, Mrs. Genter, I love you. And then Lily T. And then Sea
That's
Hero.
Right. That's right. For Cal Party. That's a that's right. It was, I just remember there was that theme that started to be, they started to beat that drum, from a publicity standpoint.
And that was a big thing. Somehow, Giles Brophy and Nick Zito snuck in there. And at the time, you got to remember when Nick Zito won in 91, Nick had been like a, sort of a low tier New York trainer. He had very few, he had a few decent stakes horses, but he was just a low tier. I used to watch Nick hang out with a bunch of guys on the third floor in the clubhouse. Just a bunch of guys in the t-shirts and stuff. Just his crew, and. I got sort of sit here only because this is one of my favorite Nick Zito lines. Giles Brophy went by the name B. Giles Brophy, with the letter B. And Nick always, always wondered about that. The guy's name was Bernie. His first name was Bernard. So he went B. He didn't want to like the name Bernie Brophy, so he went B. Giles Brophy. So Nick would always say, "Yeah, what is with this guy?" This is the way Nick talks. What is with this guy? One day he's B. Giles, one day he's Bernie Brophy, and the next day he's F. Scott Fitzgerald. Typical Nick. I mean, that's what he would say about that. But that was, but it was somehow they got snuck in there with all the geriatric owners.
I like that. Well, let's move from Sea Hero to the Haskell. And, Steve, this thing ends up, you know, just the seven's plenty. And the intrigue, obviously, is the number of horses that are front end interested. And only Dale, Everfast, is going to, you know, certainly get a pace to run at.
Speed.
Yep.
That's the race. That's the whole race right there.
Yeah.
And the intriguing part is King for a Day drawing the rail and Maximum Security drawing the seven. Because normally you'd say, oh, perfect. You know, he got all the speed inside of him. He can see what everybody does. But be careful what you wish for. Because, like I said, other than Everfast, everybody's going to want to be right there.
That's what he said,
so
yeah.
It depends on how well, even if you rate him, what are you going to rate him? You're going to rate him back to sixth? I mean, he is in danger of getting caught very wide here, because all these horses, number one, want to be first or second, and, you know, it's an opportunity to keep the favorite hung out on the outside. You know, and then King for Day not only has the rail, but he's got Jovia on directly outside of him. And Jovia, you know, is gonna go for the lead. So the whole thing is what kind of trip King for Day gets. I personally think King for Day is a very, very good horse. You know, I don't think he just happened. I know Maximum Security had, you know, stumbled at the start of that race, and he desperately needed the race, and he's definitely going to improve off of it. But Kingford just went at his throat. I mean, right from the start, and wouldn't let go. You know, he was like a terrier, you know, tugging at your pant leg. And he just wouldn't let go of him, and finally was able to get by him. I just think he's a very good horse. But you know, man, a horse like Jovia, I mean, he really surprised me in the Belmont Stakes. You know, I didn't think in the world any shot to last the way he did. You know, to be on the lead, you know, really battling on the lead throughout a mile and a half, and then still get speed less than two lengths. Actually, you know, if you look at the Derby and the Preakness and the Belmont, mostly the Preakness and the Belmont, it was like a synthetic race. I mean, it's like eight horses within three or four lengths of each other in those races. So you have to wonder, you know, I mean, you don't know how good these horses are. They're so close together in ability, no standout, is that everybody, you know, everybody is right there. And so you look at the Belmont, you know, I think like the seventh place finisher got beat three lengths. So your horses like Spinoff and Intrepid Hero, I mean, Intrepid Heart, I mean, they got, you know, they finished like seventh, eighth, something like that. They got beat like four lengths at the most, I think. So that's, it's like I said, these races seem to be almost like synthetic races. So I think, you know, I don't know if we're going to have a changing of the guard or what's going to happen when Omaha Beach comes back or, you know, the emergence of Mr. Money. And then we can have some horses coming up the following week in the Jim Dandy. And Chad Brown is absolutely crazy about this Looking for Bikinis, who was, I thought, very impressive in his last start. He ran down, you know, a really good horse, Not That Brady, had to go wide in that race, second start of his life. And not only that, but he won by half a length, and Castellano never touched him with the whip. He hand rode him the whole length of the stretch. That's how much confidence he had in. So I don't know how good he is. And even a horse like Laughing Fox, he's one of those horses, by the way, that was, I think, in the Preakness. Laughing Fox was beaten, four lengths? Finished seventh,
yep,
or something like that.
Yep.
Yeah. So he was right there. He was closing in that race. Everybody was closing. So it's just hard to know, you know, whose day it's going to be. Basically, you have a bunch of sea heroes. You just never know, well, you know, who's going to pick the big day to have their best race. So we'll see what's going to happen. But listen, the best 3-year-old in the country might be Code of Honor. The way he ran in the Dwyer, that was a very powerful performance. So we don't know. I mean, the Haskell and the Travers are going to sort a lot out and find out how good, you know, these horses really are. But like I said, there's still others, even after that, there's others waiting in the wings. You know, Mr. Money is coming up three really, really strong performances. And then Omaha Beach, hopefully, will get back and be able to make a name for himself later in the year. But, I mean, as far as the Haskell goes, I mean, to me, it's still between, you know, Maximum Security and King for a Day. Mucho Gusto, you know, of course, it's Baffert, who, you know, you won eight of these things. My only question with Mucho Gusto is if he is as effective at a mile and eighth as he is going shorter. And there's no reason, not a lot to go by. I mean, you know, he's by Mucho Macho Man out of a Giants Causeway mare. So there's no reason for him not to get a mile and eighth. So basically all we're going by is the Sunland Derby, where, you know, he was 4-5 in that race, and he went right to the lead, and they just ran right by him. I mean, he wound up getting beat six. He was third, but he was beaten like six lengths. In fact, he wanted no part of that mile and an eighth. But if he handles a mile and an eighth, you know, it is Baffert, and it'll, and he's coming off of two very strong performances in the Barrera and the Affirmed, so, and it is Baffert. You know, but, you know, from a logical handicapping standpoint, if you look at the way this race shapes up, I mean, it does set up for Everfast, who makes Sea Hero look like the most consistent horse in the country. I mean, you know what, where his Preakness came from, I have absolutely no idea. And he's another horse in the Belmont Stakes. In Belmont Stakes, so he finished seventh, so he got beat three lengths. You know, he's down on the inside, he ran terribly in the Pat Day Mile. He ran terribly in the Florida Derby. He ran terribly in the Fountain of Youth. I mean, and then he ran that big second in the Holy Bull, but he ran second to Harvey Wallbanger, who's come back and run three horrible races since then. So again, it's just a crazy crop of horses. But you know, if you're betting a trifecta here, I mean, it's got to be King for a Day, Maximum Security, and Mucho Gusto. You know, sure. Depends on which one gets the best trip. I hate to leave out Joe Villa, because he's obviously a very game horse, and he's a house horse, and he's been working over the track. But I just don't know if he's if he gets caught up in the pace or not. He got caught up in the pace in a mile and a half in the Belmont, and he didn't stop. So I don't know. I mean, if I had to bet the race, I'd probably still go for King for a Day, just for a little bit of value, because there's a possibility that Mucho Gusto might be second choice. So if he's third, he's listed as third choice at 5-2. If he's third choice in there, and listen, if he gets the trip, stays on a rail, stable ground. Mom, it's a great track for saving ground. So if he stays on the rail and he gets lucky and gets through, could come back and win again. I mean, that would be my bet only for value. But, you know, I think for racing, the best thing by far would be for Maximum Security to win. Maximum Security wins this, and Game Winner wins the Travers, and Gary West is back back in business again, you know, with arguably the two best three-year-olds in the country. And Game Winner can certainly win the Travers. He'll love the mile and a quarter, and he's coming off a good enough race at Los Al against nothing. But he didn't assert himself, actually, until in between the 8th pole and the 16th pole. But we'll see. Are they going to sort themselves out now? But from a racing fan, I'd love to see Maximum Security win. You know, just redeem himself from that. Get back on a positive note after that Derby fiasco.
Definitely, yeah.
You know, he was the best horse in the race. He ran a tremendous race for us with his background and so little racing. So, you know, it's a shame that he had to get disqualified. But, you know, it's a different time now. If he can knock off this race, and I would assume he'd go to the Cotillion with game winner going to the Travers, I don't see them running against each other. So he would probably go the straight to the...
Pennsylvania Derby.
Oh, well, same track at least. He would go straight there. So it's see what happens. It should be should be an interesting race. It should be a jockey's race.
They all
That's what happens, Steve. When you get old, you come up with crazy things like Cotillion instead of Pennsylvania Derby.
That's all right. That's all right. Tony Black, the time I brought it up, didn't even remember that he won a Cotillion. So,
well,
don't feel bad.
I got Cotillion on my brain because I just written a column about my Juliet in the Cotillion. You know, running against Hot and Nasty in a big showdown in the Cotillion. They had both won divisions of the Test Stakes, and they faced off in the Cotillion. So I was writing about the Cotillion, so I had the Cotillion on my brain because I had just written... I had just written a big column about my Julia going into the Hall of Fame and went over her entire career. So I was that was Cotillion on the brain.
Are you writing the program insert for the Hall?
No,
I wasn't sure. I don't remember. I can't remember if they. I know they do it, right? They do it. Yeah.
You mean in a program? You mean?
Yeah. For the induction ceremony.
I didn't even know they put out a program.
I think they do. Maybe it's a magazine. It's like a Hall of Fame magazine, I think, that I'm pretty, right? There's a magazine every year.
I would imagine Brian probably does that.
Yeah, probably. By the way, I got a
Travers
book.
I will be there. I'm looking forward to it.
You're going to have to get a Travers book because you're going to love it.
Sounds unbelievable.
Yeah, it's great. You're going to love it.
The way you made it sound, it sounds like it weighs 20 pounds.
It does. It tips the scales. And actually, you know what might be fun is to try to collect autographs on the pages of each of the, you know, as many as you can get. That might be fun to do. Because, you know, it's funny. I've got a point given. I've got a framed print of Point Given winning with the program, with the silks and all that, you know, coming out of, you know, it's a page taken right out of the Travers program. And these were very popular. They're still popular. But it's fading. The signatures are fading and I keep it out of the sun. And maybe I should have changed the glass on it, but, they're kind of fading away on me. Well, it's been, and it's 18 years, so 2001.
I think the Travers is becoming more and more prestigious as it's always been. I think people are starting to look at the Travers as a classic. I think it is a classic, to tell you the truth. You know, they call it the Midsummer Derby, but to me it's become a classic. I think a lot of people, there were people that would rather win the Travers than the Kentucky Derby. I'm not saying a lot, but there are some.
Well, the New York base, Mike Rapoli talked about that for years, about winning the Wood, the Belmont, and the Travers, that those three meant as much or more to him than anything.
I'll bet you it means a lot to Chad Brown. I know it means a lot. It meant a lot last year to Bob LaPenta. He got very emotional going to Saratoga since he was a kid. And yeah, when you have that kind of a background,
right?
You know, it's big. I've been to a lot of Travers. I've seen a lot of Travers. My first Travers was 1968, so I've been to a lot of Travers. So you know, you can always feel the importance of it. And it's always been an important race, but I really feel like it's become a classic.
I think it's
getting to be almost as prestigious, as not as prestigious as maybe not the Kentucky Derby, but you know the Preakness, Belmont, and a lot of people remember the Travers as much as they do the second two legs of the Triple Crown.
I won't argue. It's one of our favorites, and so is this race, Haskell. Haskell has its own place as well. The, you know, the thing
I guess Bob, Bob Baffert doesn't have to go to Max's. He can eat. I wonder if it works the same. By the way, if he eats at the Max's stand at the track now, or if he has to go to the original Max's too.
I think you have to go to the original. You have to go to the original.
He doesn't even have to go anymore. He said he's Jimmy Barnes. That works.
That's right. After the heart attack, he was supposed to stay away.
Right, exactly. By the way, in case anybody's interested, Max's has very good veggie burgers.
Oh, there you go. You got to get one in. Steve, I got Brad Thomas is going to join me for the first time in ages. I never seem to be able to get him. So let me pull up, and I'll take a break, and Brad's going to come down here any moment, and I'll recap this with you next week.
All right, Steve. Well, you enjoy yourself and stay cool. It's going to be a tad on the warmer side tomorrow.
Yeah.
Saturday, I mean.
Yeah, no doubt. And we hope there's not an issue. I mean, we're going to find out later.
Delaware canceled Saturday already. But I know they have this new protocol, you know, with all the misters and the extra hoses, and they're going to need it. You know, everybody always says, well, Mom, it's better because it's by the ocean and you get the breeze. I got to tell you, I don't want to put a damper on it, but Mama's is one of the hottest racetracks because of all the asphalt in the back, you know, where the paddock is. That sun just bakes down off that asphalt. You know, it's not like there's grass back there or anything. It's just just a sheet of asphalt in the back. And believe me, breeze or no breeze, it gets hot at that racetrack. In fact, the hottest I've ever been in a racetrack is in Atlantic City, which is right on the water, you know, close to the water itself, because the humidity comes in off the ocean. So it makes it even hotter. I didn't mean to end as a killjoy, but switch. I remember sweltering.
Jesus.
Mama's.
Yeah.
Sorry. I apologize.
That's all right. Well, Steve, this is great. I appreciate it. We'll see what happens, and we'll look forward to talking Jim Dandy and Haskell Recap next week.
Okay, boss, you also realize, by the way, Monmouth Park was the first track ever to have air conditioning in the press box.
That I would not be aware of.
Yes, they were the first to do a lot of things. First to have the closed-circuit TVs, first to post shoe information on the boards, first to have the replays. I mean, it's an innovation. But one of them was having air conditioning in the press box. So just to let you know. You can go up there and cool off. It's a historic air conditioner.
Oh, I love it. Well, we might be doing that and hiding out a little bit when it comes to Saturday.
The Mammoth press box is a spawning ground. I remember when the young kid that used to work up in the press box was named Jim Gagliano. He was like a gopher up there, and he worked up in the press box and. Then you'd see him trailing
Hal,
wherever Hal Handel went. There was a little Jimmy Gagliano following him around and, you know, learning the ropes. And now look at him. Now he's head of the jockey club. So that's the place to be. You want a job, go to Mammoth Park.
A lot of people. Hammer as well. Rick will be back with us tomorrow. There's some news to look for later today involving Rick. Kind of drop a little bit of a hint, and I'll just tell you to watch the news wire, Steve.
I'll certainly do that. Sounds like good news for him, so I'm happy for him, whatever it is.
Yeah, it's very good. It's good for everybody. I'll take a break here. We've got about 15 into hour three. Brad Thomas is going to join us. We're going to talk to Pat McKenna and Rich Eng as well over the next 45 minutes. We're at Mammoth, and predictably, the morning has flown by. Back after this.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
DRF Sports Form Digital Edition, your ultimate weekly betting guide. Published by Daily Racing Form, DRF Sports Form delivers all of the analysis and insight you need for every NFL game and more than 40 college football matchups. Beat the spread with powerful trends and sharp angles. Tap into best bets, expert picks, parlay winners, and more. All for just $4.99 per issue. Get this week's edition free. Visit drf.com/sportsform. Enter code DRF Sports.
University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program can prepare you for an exciting career in racing. Turn your passion into a paycheck. Nearly 90% of our students are employed in the racing industry immediately upon graduation. What career track are you on? The University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program. Enroll today and get on track for success. For scholarship opportunities and more, check out our website at ua-rtip.org.
Do you ever wonder what happens to your old friends, including the great champions that inspired unforgettable memories, and maybe even let you cash a ticket or two over the years? We even have a former child prodigy.
Here is a superstar. That horse's name is Afternoon Delights, and Kent the Summerlin Afternoon Delights absolutely galloping in the Hollywood Futurities.
These are the champions that help out the horses that might not have won a Grade 1 race, but always tried just as hard. Come visit them all at Old Friends when you're in Kentucky or at our Bobby Frankel division, Old Friends in Saratoga. I know they'll be glad to see you. Go to oldfriendsequine.org or call us at 502-863-1775.
Get started in Kentucky. Over $8 million in additional purse money is available at the five Kentucky tracks for horses eligible for the Kentucky Thoroughbred Division.
DRF Sports Form Digital Edition, your ultimate weekly betting guide. Published by Daily Racing Form, DRF Sports Form delivers all of the analysis and insight you need for every NFL game and more than 40 college football matchups. Beat the spread with powerful trends and sharp angles. Tap into best bets, expert picks, parlay winners, and more. All for just $4.99 per issue. Get this week's edition free. Visit drf.com/sportsform. Enter code DRF Sports.
Now, back to At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
Back at Monmouth Park. Coming up on 20 into hour three, fast moving Thursday. And yesterday, of course, they pulled together Haskell Day. And we were talking earlier about how long it took to get the PPs out, Brad. And that must have been chopping at the bit waiting for them to produce.
Usually I'm able to get a start on it on the day of the draw. This year, unable to do that. So I'm really hustling a little bit to do both the morning line and the selections. It's kind of a process where you have to be schizophrenic, because when you're doing the morning line, you're trying to think like the public. When you're doing your selections, you're trying to think like yourself. And when you're someone like me, those two things tend to be very, very different. So you have to really, really I try to distance myself from the two processes as much as possible. This year, it's not possible. So I've been like shooting electro probes into my head to try to get me to change up.
It's great to have you here live, and it's probably my fault, because I should have, with these trips down here, I should call ahead a couple of days and block you in, because I can't remember. It's got to be 10 years since you've been on with me.
It's been a long time, and I have to take my share of the blame. It's just a matter of what people don't realize is I know people see me on a train on a Thursday, and they'll say, what are you going to Monmouth Park for? And they say, and I'll say to them, what do you think? I just show up the day of the race and I just open my mouth and things come out and I haven't done any preparation or anything. Actually, on a lot of the days before the racing, that's when I'm busiest, because I'm doing all the groundwork.
For those that, anybody that follows Monmouth at all knows Brad, and one of the most respected opinions in all of the sport. And give everybody a snapshot of your process and your approach when you handicap?
Well, there's 23,111 reasons why horses might win or lose races. And handicapping, to some extent, is figuring out the one, two, or three of those factors that are the most important ones in this particular instance. So I'm eclectic, and it's work intensive because you have to juggle all of these things, and it makes things hectic, and it makes things difficult at times. But when you're right, it's rewarding. And I've always felt that one of the unfair things in the game is you might work 100% harder than somebody else, and maybe that makes you 5% better, and you might make 200% work 200% harder than somebody, and that only adds maybe 2 or 3% to the equation. So it's an inverse relationship. But and people who play horses know that small percentages become very, very meaningful when added up over time. That 5%, that 2 or 3%, that can ultimately be the difference between winning and losing.
What kind of races, what conditions generally do you light you up and that you particularly look forward to betting and capping and formulating plays and betting?
Big fields, pace scenarios that may be a little bit cloudy, but at the same time contain pace elements, more than one or two of them, and fields that also have name connections, but also lower profile connections that are very, very capable and frequently under-regarded by the public.
I like that. And, you know, when you talk about pace scenarios, there's a lot of people that will gravitate to extreme pace scenarios, extremely slow anticipated or extremely fast. When you say murky, do you mean uncertain pace scenarios where you can pick out a horse that is tactical and is going to be able to force themselves into the picture?
It could be that, or it could be a horse who I know is faster than the other pace horses. Sometimes you'll see 3 or 4 pace horses in a race, but some of them are fake pace horses. They're only ones who are able to make the lead when there's nobody else in the race who can really make the lead. If you know who the fastest pace horse is, you can have an advantage. Because especially what we see in the modern game very, very frequently is what you see on paper and expect strategy-wise is not always what you get, because there's so much more sophistication in how trainers and jockeys read past performances and analyze races that you'll see a race where there should be a lot of pace, but every other trainer, every other rider is looking at it as well, and they say, we're not going to be the pace. We're not going to commit suicide. And somebody who does go, who does say, okay, let's bite the bullet and send, they can frequently be all alone on the front end. So when I see it, and you can be really frustrated with that scenario, and that's one of the reasons to look for horses who are overlays, because if you bet an underlay under that circumstance, you're going to be in trouble. So I like scenarios where I'm pretty confident that the pace horses are going to go, but I know who the best pace horse is. Or I'm really confident the pace horses are going to go, and I know they're relatively equal, so that tactical horse or that come-from-behind horse might be the right horse to have. I think it just comes down to like being able to analyze pace and really understanding who is the fastest and who isn't.
You mentioned jocks and trainers and intent and aptitudes, and there's been, certainly in your tenure, at this venue, there's been a parade of jocks. Right now, it's Paco Lopez, who you know is aggressive. And if a trainer reaches for a Paco with a horse that may have speed, it's one of those things that you can envision and saying, this horse may end up, just by virtue of Paco getting the call, that this horse is going to be in the race earlier, and that might be something that he really needs. Mm-hmm. And it's something the public won't necessarily perceive when they look at the past performances.
Lopez is more one when he gets on a horse like that, that he may not necessarily be on the lead, but he'll be moving earlier than
go.
The horses for other jockeys. That's really what you see most with him. Jose Ferrer, he's the guy that when he's on a horse like the one that you described, that horse is in all likelihood going to be sent for everything. Ferrer is hyper aggressive on horses with live shots who are some early foot. He's a true believer in you have to be in the game in order to win the game, and he puts horses in play. Lopez will move earlier, but maybe not necessarily right on the front end. And the thing that makes Lopez so great here is he's riding a mini bike, and a lot of the other jockeys are riding SUVs. And he can do things with horses that even other top jockeys can't do. He can, and that doesn't mean he doesn't have weaknesses that they have strengths in, but his strength is his ability to maneuver a horse like a mini bike and just do things in traffic, do things efficiently around turns, and do things efficiently when angling out and altering course that other riders can't do. And it's those inches and feet that he steals when he does that that oftentimes decides races.
Another aspect of Monmouth and the Mid-Atlantic in general is the interchangeability and the ship in, whether it's Pennsylvania outfits, Delaware, et cetera, New York outfits sending, I don't want to call them B-strings. I mean, it's no different than the Kentucky trainers that left horses in Kentucky versus the horses they took to Saratoga. But Chad Brown and Todd Pletcher, et cetera, have strings, down here. Talk about the mix and match aspect, Brad, of, more or less evaluating the domestic, the local stock versus the shippers.
I'll almost always go local over the shippers unless I'm thoroughly convinced that this shipper is the absolute top tier. With a lot of the New York trainers, you have to look at motivations. They'll bring a horse to New Jersey, and it'll be a homebred that hasn't been successful at Gulfstream or Belmont or just racing on the fringes. The horse comes here. Maybe you could say that this horse is over the top at this particular time, trying to run over their head against better competition. And now coming to New Jersey, facing weaker, theoretically should be able to handle this field. But at the same time, maybe the best bullets already have been fired. Whereas a local who's pointed for this particular race and who is improving may not have been as good as this horse a couple months ago, but maybe now and on this track will be.
Let's talk pace scenario and the horses that we know are involved in the feature on Saturday, because, Brad, this is an unusual circumstance. You got 7 horse field. You've got 6 horses that want to be on or near. And then there's Everfast. What do you think happens when they open the gate?
Well, when there's 6 horses in a million-dollar race in which second, third, and fourth money pay pretty good, all 6 of them aren't going to go. So the pay scenario, to me, I would say, is a little bit murky. Excuse me. Maybe the two most interesting things I would say is, number one, Maxim Security has been inside as speed, as a front-running speed in his signature performances. Now he's outside everybody. I don't see him being speed on the inside. Before, he was able to kind of dictate some terms on the inside how fast everybody else would run. Now I think he's going to be reacting to others. How he does in that role, I'm not certain. I really like his races in the Kentucky Derby and the Florida Derby, in that he was able to, a lot of times with these three-year-olds, you see them break open races with big third quarters. In the Florida Derby, the Kentucky Derby, he broke those races open with big fourth quarters, relatively speaking, to how the track was run.
Yep.
Now, to me, that says this horse has a whole lot of stamina. And I know I was even bandied about that he would be pointing for the Belmont after the Derby, before how nicked up he was after the Derby became clear. And I think he would have been really, really tough in the Belmont because of that. But now he's going to be in a position where he is probably going to be tested more severely by horses to his inside, where he's going to have to run a sharper third quarter than he's going to be running, and then asked to really make that fourth quarter move that he has been making. I think that could be a test for him on the outside, because there will be speed somewheres, and I think these are quality horses. Mucho Gusto is to his inside, and even though Mucho Gusto has shown he can rate somewhat, I don't really see Baffert and Talamo saying, okay, we're going to take back and we're not going to put ourselves in a position to carry Maximum Security three or four wide on the first turn. That's just race riding, and I think that's something that is going to change the dynamic here for Maximum Security. The second thing I see is King for a Day, who beat Maximum Security last time, set outside Maximum Security. That was the garden spot on that particular day. Now he's inside everybody. I don't think King for a Day wants to pass a whole bunch of horses. But at the same time, I don't think he wants to be on the lead from the rail either. So I think it's going to be a real challenge for John Velazquez to extricate King for a Day from that inside position and to work out a trip that this horse can really thrive under. I like the way he's going form-wise. I think he's ready for a big race. I'm just not so sure he's going to be in position to run it. Now, that said, nobody in the last few years has ridden these types of horses in these kind of races better than John Velazquez
well,
has.
A good point. That's a great point. I also want to fold in the presence of Jovia next to King for a Day. How aggressive do you expect Lascano to be? I mean, after that, everybody can talk about the gold rail all they want. A gold rail it'll carry you for a certain period, but for him to stay on the way he did in that Belmont is a real feather in his cap, and mm-hmm. This horse is underappreciated.
He's an improving horse. He's a good horse. I think, to me, that performance, the combination of the very, very good rail and the distance is what really helped him as well, because I think he was allowed a little bit of freedom early in that race, because nobody wants to use their horse in modern day horse racing going a mile and a half, because you know none of these horses want to run a mile and a half. So every other speed horse is more than willing to say to Jovia, you're going to get a pass for the first three-eighths of a mile. And I think that really helped him, as well as being on the best part of the track. Now, whatever his position is, whether he's actually on the lead, whether he's off of somebody, he's going to have to be going a lot faster, and he's going to be under a lot more pressure. And that's what I need to see him be able to do that. My initial feeling is the pace horses here, like Maximum Security, King for a Day, even Mucho Gusto, if he does turn out to be a pace horse here, I think those horses match up very favorably against what Jovia was competing with in the Belmont, both the other pace horses and the two horses who came from behind to beat him, Sir Winston and Tacitus. And I think it's that combination of a different pace situation and probably better horses that he's going to have to deal with.
You ready to make a pick in this, or are you going to hold off till?
I'm not ready to make
time.
A pick, but what I will tell you is I will be keying Mucho Gusto, because to me he's the likeliest horse to be there. And I will be using a lot of Everfast, because I think the pace scenario is going to help him. After that, it's wide open.
And that's a legitimate way to, you know, we talk about the reverse tri-key. Everfast, a horse you can easily envision running late, getting up for at least a piece, fourth, third, second. Who knows if he can win. But if it completely collapses, there's also a fun storyline in here, Brad. I talk whenever I come to Monmouth about what a family atmosphere it is, how generations of people have worked here. You know, people working here now, they're parents, both of their parents worked here. Their grandparents might have worked here. The Jersey breeder and the Jersey owner, it's very cool to have the Brunettis represented here with King for a Day and Red Oak, and then, of course, the Fazio brothers, and I give them all the credit in the world. I ran into them at King Umberto's on Thursday, I think, of Belmont Week, and a bunch of their friends, and they it seemed like a somewhat foolhardy placement. Mm-hmm. And they were fully rewarded, and give them tremendous credit. I can't imagine what goes on here if Jovia somehow wins a Haskell.
I think it was great because the game is supposed to be about reaching. We're supposed to test these horses.
Yep.
We're supposed to determine who the best in the breed is. And the numbers crunching trainers that avoid spots, avoid risk, avoid putting their horses in stressful situations, to me, I think that's taken away something from the game, and it's taken something away from the breeding industry. We're supposed to test athletes, to drive them to their limits and maybe even beyond those limits in a reasonable way and a safe way. That's what the game is supposed to be about. That's what we're supposedly trying to get breeding stock to show before they're given that chance to breed. So I give Sacco, I give the Fazios, I give Jovia credit for taking that aggressive tack and, as you said, Steve, being rewarded by it. And I think we need to see more trainers, more owners do that.
Before I let you go, favorite Haskell over the years?
It's really hard for me to even say. I've never even thought about it. I would say the Ali Sheba bet twice, Lost Code won, was a great race, and it was also meaningful to me because I was attended it with a teacher of mine from high school who I was very, very close to. So it was fun to go to a horse racing and get a race like that in that type of company.
I love it. How about your best score in a Haskell?
It probably was, I just told this story. I'll tell it again. Do we have a couple minutes?
Yeah, of course.
Okay. 99% of the time, more than that, if I'm betting, I will bet my selections, but I make it clear that horse racing is a fluid, changeable game and the selections are made well in advance. Things and conditions can change.
Of course.
I will not bet against the selections unless I have tweeted accordingly or have said on the air that things have changed. This is what any thinking, sane handicapper must do. In Bayern's Haskell year, there was a huge, huge speed bias, huge bias. Bayern could not lose the Haskell that year because of that. There was no speed that could run with him in the race, and the track was carrying it. He's 4-1 on the board with a few minutes to go. I mean, overlay of the absolute century. I can't believe it. So I walk out to the grandstand. I say, I have to bet on Bayern. The windows with human beings are lines are full. Half the automated machines are down. The ones that aren't down, there's multiple people at. I'm going to get shut out. But there's one machine where there's only one person. It's a gentleman who I would estimate was 80 years old, wearing shorts and yellow socks, betting 10-cent supers at some harness track. I can't remember the harness track. I have a voucher in my pocket. All other things, what I have, my only other possession in my pocket is $35 in cash, which is going to be my cab fare home from the train station. It's a late night. I have to get home. I have people I have to take care of. So that's my cab fare. So I go to the guy with the yellow socks. I said, I will give you $35 right now to leave this window. I gave him $35. I never saw someone that age move with that alacrity. He left his voucher in the machine. I punch it out. It's like $1.20 or $1.30. I can't remember. I leave it on the counter and I wave to him, but I don't think he saw me. I take my voucher and I bet the entire voucher on Bayern. So he better have won because I would have been walking home if he didn't.
That's a tremendous story. Our friend Tom Herman is asking me to ask you the story about betting rye at sea.
Oh, my goodness. That was a horse at the Meadowlands who shipped up to Maryland, shipped up to the Meadowlands from Maryland about
30 years ago.
More than that. 37 years ago, probably. 36 or 37 years ago. Finished second, was the horse who won the race, was disqualified and put up, and I think it was something like $135, $140, something in that range.
Was his win, he was 60 or 70 to 1?
He finished second at 60 and or 70 got put to up. 1. And the horse, I can't remember the horse's name. I was trying to think of the horse's name who was disqualified. I can't. That was at the Meadowlands. So I guess theoretically, that means I can never like claim bad luck with a disqualification.
You having get put up the Palisades handicap.
Was it the Palisades?
It was the Palisades handicap.
Okay, what year was it? Do you know what year?
It was
82 or 83.
80.
80. It was that
November 6, 1980.
39 years ago. I wasn't of legal age. No, I was 19. Though it might have been 21 at the time. I don't know.
The statute of limitations is expired.
I would hope.
Why'd you pick a 60-70 to one shot?
He was. I knew in those days that was pre-simulcasting. People on one circuit did not know what was going on
yep.
another circuit.
Yep.
I followed Maryland racing. I worked in an office where I covered all tracks, so I knew that this horse was live. So I didn't think he would be 60 or 70 to 1. I didn't think he was going to win, but I knew he was should be 10 to 1, and instead was 60 or 70 to 1. But these days, he wouldn't have been that because people would have had
know.
Speed figures.
It's amazing.
Right.
It's a video.
They would have seen him run.
Exactly.
You know, people never would see these horses. I mean, I remember it was one of the greatest trips I saw ever was a two-year-old. A Darby Dan two-year-old in a excuse me, a Darby Dan two-year-old in a race, first-time starter in a race at Aqueduct that Cordero was supposed to ride. Cordero got hurt. He was okay, but he couldn't ride that day. Another rider who never rode for the Connection was on board, and this rider was the absolute best at giving a horse who wasn't meant first-time out a trip. And he delivered. And like three people in the grandstand was like screaming at him at the eighth pole to give him the fake whip, which is what we called his left-handed whip. Because when you looked at it on the pan shot, he's flailing away left-handed. When you would look at it on the head-on shot, which in those days was only available twice, right after the replay, right after the race when it was replayed, and then again at 11 o'clock in the morning the next day when
right.
the track first opened.
Right.
There was never seen on a replay show, never seen on the internet. You saw it the head-on twice. So the head-on shot, of course, revealed flailing away but never touching the horse.
Just arm motion.
But it was November. The Connections went to Florida. And 3 months later, you got a racing form. Charts were published in the racing form, and you'd say, holy whatever, the horse ran a Hialeah and won in paid so-and-so, and you had no idea the horse was even running.
Yeah.
So now you have stable mail, and you know the horse could run in Asia, and you'll know it.
It's true. And on that topic, what for you are some of, or even one of, the last hidden angles and hidden approaches that haven't been, so widely glommed onto?
The best angles are subtle trips that aren't caught in company lines, that most people who watch trips just see the obvious, and everyone is seeing the same obvious stuff. The trips that are important now are the ones pace-wise when horses are moving into fast paces or not moving when they should be moving, evaluating turf trips, because many times horses who are pocketed and look like they want to go and can't go actually are benefiting from not being able to go at that particular time.
That's an interesting take.
And it's good that they're not going, because if they went now, they would move too early and someone would catch them. So maybe looking at the horses in those turf races who are the ones who are moving too early, who had the clearance but are moving too early. And being able to evaluate a race on its own, not being formulaic in how you look at a trip, looking at it in the context of the individual horses, what is expected of those horses, and in the context of how the race itself is being run.
And, you know, you in that regard, you and Andy Serling share that same mentality in that. I remember on the You Bet show, that
was a good show.
That he would have you on and admired, you know, that those subtleties that you were looking, you were a kind of counterintuitive trip handicapping, not just the, you know, oh, so-and-so was blocked for the length of the stretch.
If you're... I mean, in the old days when people actually watch replays at the track after the race, if you were watching a replay and everybody watching it was screaming about what was happening to a horse, you know that was completely worthless the next time.
Exactly. Well, this game in general and horseplay and the opportunities are invariably the things that, you know, going counter to where the public is going. I mean, that's at the heart of the whole paramutual system.
It's counterintuitiveness because people like to, there's security in numbers. People say to you, who do you like? And you agree with them. They say, yeah, of course, that's the horse. Yeah, without a doubt. And I'll tell you a little secret. When people agree with me, I don't like it.
Then you get worried.
I don't like it at all because most people, myself included, are wrong more times than they're right. If I really like a horse a lot and the horse is going to be a price and I'll see that this horse has some buzz around them, I simply will not bet the horse.
Yeah,
I simply won't. Even if it's a horse who's just running the third race at Oshkosh Downs and, you know, six people are picking the horse, I don't want it. Let the horse win.
That's an Andyism, you know, where he and I will be talking. He says, you know, I kind of liked so-and-so, but God, he can't possibly win because everybody now likes him.
And it's true. I mean, not only if so many people are on the same wavelength, they're not going to be right. And that's just, I mean, it's human beings, their fallibility in horse racing and everything else.
Well, one of the really unique approaches and opinions, you can follow Brad and his addition to Twitter, Brad Shades Off, invaluable insights. You watch him pre-races and the ability to go back and really, you know, discern and hold that material and that education and then applying it down the road. I mean, this is your approach in general. I mean, that's how you succeed playing the game, is being studious and thorough and tireless. I mean, people think, oh, you know, you can't win. You can win. You don't win all the time, but, you know,
it's eight steps forward, seven steps back, nine steps forward, 10 steps back, but then 13 steps forward and only eight steps back. And it's a matter, too, of it's so true what the experts say who are money management experts. It's the big scores that mitigate all the little defeats. You have to have a big score to really mitigate all the little losses along the way. So there's a lot of ways to get a big score these days, and you have to go for it, but at the same time, you have to realize that you're going to lose a lot to get there. And you hear a lot of people say, oh, I've been losing, so I've stopped playing. Well, then you need to do something about managing your bankroll so you can play continuously. It's a merry-go-round, and once you jump on it, you better stay on it. Otherwise, you're going to lose opportunities. You have to be consistent.
And that statement, Brad, I'm going to guess and suggest that you find the game as exciting and as rewarding as it ever has been.
Of course, there's things about it that are not nearly as good as they were 30 or 40 years ago. But you can say that about so many aspects of life. But there's also things about it that are better. You could come to Monmouth Park in 1976 and see really, really good horses every single Saturday. But you could only bet one daily double, one trifecta, no pick threes or pick fours or pick fives or pick sixes or even superfectas in that time. So your options were limited, and I'm a big believer that it's options and the ability to discern the right options for this particular circumstance. That's the opportunity to really succeed big time.
On that topic, actually, you invite another question. Have you changed your bankroll application in this era much at all, or do you still basically play the meat and potato that you always have?
No, I evolve. What I do is I actually establish separate funds for different types of bets.
Interesting.
I'll have triple crown bets where, of course, for races like the Derby, I'm playing the vertical wagers very, very aggressively because of the number of horses and the potential value if you're right with horses at prices. You have to take that approach almost as a mutual fund all in of itself to play, and you have to take that approach over the full body of your lifetime, because if you live for 30 more years, you're counting on maybe one or two or three times out of that 30 years to hit the big score. Because if you do hit the big score, that can easily be six figures in that race if you play it the right way. So that's how you have to approach it. So if you lose $1,200 on, you know, May 3rd, whatever, it's meaningless in the big equation. But understood, you have to have the bankroll to do that. You have to be willing to do that. But if you have investments in the stock market or some other form of big-time modern investment, you're doing that same thing over time as well. So I kind of approach horse racing in that respect. I'll have a fund established for 5-2, 3-1 can't-lose horses. Just bet them to win 10 times a year. I might use that.
That's true.
I'll have a fund for 38-1 shots that I think are unlikely to finish first or second, but I really, really think I can single them in the third spot, and it's controllable on the other slots, and I have some prices there to work with. I have a fund for that. So that's how I approach the game. Maybe the hardest part is looking at a card, at all the cards on a given day, and saying, okay, I'm going to bring this fund in here. I'm going to bring that fund in there. The problem is the combination of the time it takes to handicap as well as the time it takes to plot the bets. Most players spend 90% of the time doing their handicapping and 10% of the time plotting the bets, which is the wrong way. If anything, it should be the reverse, because it's a successful plotting of the bet that is the real difference between winners and losers. There's a lot of people can handicap, a lot of them. There's people who you're absolutely amazed. You may look at them and say, you know, what could this person know? And then you talk to them and you say, my goodness, really some really, really good stuff, because you just never know in this game. But the weakness that almost everybody has is how to play. And I tell people, this is a cliche of mine that people who know me know I've said it many, many times. If you could be the 3,000th best money manager in horse racing, or the best handicapper in horse racing, what would you rather be? And, of course, everybody would say the best handicapper, so they can get a trophy and accept an Eclipse Award and do who knows what and brag about it. But the person who's the 3,000th best plotter of bets and money manager, that person's going to make more money, I promise.
No, it's a point well taken. And I'll also add in addition to better apportioning of strategy for ticket building, post-race analysis, and you know, there's just as much to be gained by spending time after a bad day. People have a tendency, oh, I'm going to turn the page. No, don't turn the page. Go back and figure out, did I handicap improperly? Did racing luck conspire against me? Did I structure ticket wrong? I mean, people are so, just don't spend nearly enough time going back and looking at the day's results, and you could probably do yourself more favors that way than extra time handicapping the next day.
Well, it should be constant self-evaluation. It should be constant self-evaluation in everything you do in real life as well. That's the measure of anybody, their ability to improve personally as well as professionally as well as in horse racing. So getting in the habit of doing it in horse racing is going to help you in any endeavor that you choose. I mean, I actually review what I do horse racing wise, betting wise, many times during the course of the year. And I'll find that there's trainers whose the way that they're doing things or their success of doing things has changed now as opposed to the way it was 3 months ago or 6 months ago. Maybe they just have better horses. Maybe they have a couple new assistants. Maybe they have a new vet. Who knows what the reasons are, but something has changed and I've underregarded this barn and I need to adjust to it. Or there might be a horse who I dismissed a couple years ago as a non-lead changing green 2-year-old who has now developed into a professional, and I'm still biased against that horse based upon things that I saw years ago that
Absolutely.
No longer are true.
Absolutely.
And I have to adjust and change, and I think that's something that everybody needs to do. Or, you know, I'm constantly not spreading enough in multi-race wagers. I'm trying to handicap them too much. I'm a big believer in singling in as many places as possible and taking risks. But at the same time, you have to know in spread races how deeply to spread.
Yeah.
And the investment is actually relatively small relative to the potential gain if you do have some singles. And that's something I have to constantly remind myself because I'm from the 60s and the 70s. I'm thinking win, win, win. And I'm somebody who I don't, my win percentage isn't high enough. I like too many prices. So when I don't have a strong opinion, I need to spread because my top opinion is too outlandish at times, frankly.
And I agree. And if you have that mentality, and I'm a big pick forward and now pick five player, the best scores are there. These pick fives with the 15% take are an even lower in some places, are an incredible value, and not being afraid of getting super narrow there's been a certain mentality that is called for a single. You don't have to single in every multi-race ticket, but pressing your strong opinion and casting that wide net where you need to, it's invaluable because if you say to yourself, I can't afford to go six deep, whoa. You have to go six. If you know you need to go six deep, go ahead and go six deep and make sure you get that price horse because that's the key to the whole ticket.
If you can't afford that six horse, then you shouldn't be playing the game. And that's just, frankly, that's just the way it is. And because the worst bets are the ones where you don't bet them properly because the funds aren't there. And people just have to, if you shouldn't even be looking at that type of bet. If you can't fund it properly, you should be looking at bets that you can fund properly. You'll have a better chance to win.
Well, and there's also another answer to that. When you're looking at a pick four, let's say, or a pick five, and you're in that and you reach that roadblock, bet a double.
Mm-hmm.
Trim back to a smaller multi-race wager. Don't just give up all the work you've already put right in and say, well, I'm just going to bet this one vertically. Well, no. You can still bet a multi, but it doesn't have to be a pick four. It could be a pick three or a double.
And that comes back to kind of where we start the conversation, that it's about the plethora of options that you have, understanding the option to pull out in this instance. I think too many people go into it saying, I'm going to bet the pick five, and then they start working on it. You should do your handicapping work first
and then
come back and say, well, how am I going to leverage the
opinions
I have here? I mean, one thing that I have to do, one of my personal talking points is going to be I have to work more on pick fives. I don't play enough of them. I have to play more of them because of the takeout. The takeout forces you to focus on that because that's everything. The price of the wager is so significantly lower. But my problem with the pick five, again, is the fact that my natural handicapping tendencies don't allow me to pick enough winners. So it adds another geometric element to me having to to get a slot right. So that's something that I have to work on. I have to get on into a mentality of, even in races where I'm not spreading deep, maybe handicapping the three or the four slots that are available there more precisely.
Can't get more informative and insightful than Brad Thomas. Brad, happy Haskell. Good luck this weekend. Thanks so much.
My pleasure, Steve. Thank you.
A real treat for everybody. Already feedback rolling in on a Brad Thomas visit. Brad Shades Off on Twitter and on the Monmouth feed. Back here tomorrow for weekend preview at the races. I've got selections up. I'll try to get the multis, including that pick six at New York today. $30,000 carryover in the pick six. And the scratches were pretty nominal. Even off the turf, I told you all those MTOs. The seventh race has got nine horses. The tenth race has got nine horses. So still very playable. And, of course, Del Mar later. HRRN today, 3 o'clock for coverage. Replay here, 6 to 9. I'll talk to you in the morning, everybody. Have a great day.